Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. First off, we had some technical difficulties with last week's interview with Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan and Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander. A portion of that program didn't air, but we'll be bringing that to you in the last half hour of the show today. I want to apologize to listeners and let you know that you can hear the entire program online at wpr.org/superior. But we begin today's program with a discussion about homelessness in the region. Across Wisconsin, more than 5,000 people are without a home on any given night. In Minnesota, it's closer to 7,700 people. That's according to federal data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. In this hour, we're talking about issues surrounding homelessness in northern Wisconsin and the Twin Ports. Our guests include Millie Roundsville, CEO of Northwest Wisconsin Community Services Agency in Superior, and Kim Randolph, Stabilizing Services Director with CHUM in Duluth. Up first, we hear from Millie Roundsville about how she's preparing for next week's point-in-time count. The annual effort seeks to get a snapshot of how many people are living in shelters or on the streets for one night in January.
The point-in-time is something that HUD has started several years ago, and each community kind of does maybe once a year, twice a year. Wisconsin's always done twice a year, so they've chosen to kind of excel more than what's required. So it's always that fourth Wednesday in January, and then the fourth Wednesday in July. So on those point in time dates, every community throughout the entire state of Wisconsin is all going out. We don't start until 11 o'clock at night, and we wrap up by 6 in the morning. So throughout the state of Wisconsin, each community has got various groups that go out into the communities, so we're all out at the same time, trying to reach out to individuals who may be living in their cars, living on the streets, and then trying to connect them to services if they know about them, don't know about them, give them some care packages, but really trying to engage, getting individuals to at least come in and seek services and make sure they know what's available.
And is this for people who are living in shelters or just on the streets or both?
The point in time numbers, there's two pieces. Obviously, the first point of the data is within our databases. So ourselves in Harbor House, we use what's called Service Point. So the numbers are in that HMIS system. CASDA and Northwoods Women, which is out of Ashland, they also have shelters. So in our five-county service area we work in, there is only the four of us that provide homeless services. So those numbers are what's called the sheltered count. So we take into account, you know, how many people are residing at each of the various facilities. We do also work with St. Vincent de Paul here in Superior and Ashland Cares out of Ashland. They've been two of our partners that also assist in our street counts. And if we come across somebody that is in need of shelter that evening, they'll issue hotel vouchers. So those would also be included in that sheltered number. For those that we come across that are not interested in shelter or haven't connected yet with shelter, or we come across them 8 o'clock Monday morning or the next morning, and they say they were sleeping in their car the night before, those are the unsheltered numbers that we report.
And how long have you been with Northwest Wisconsin Community Services Agency?
It will be 21 years in May.
Okay. So during that time, what have you seen then as far as homelessness in the region?
I've seen an improvement in services since we started. The Solid Rock, as I was briefly mentioning earlier, the Solid Rock turns 80 this year. So that program has been providing shelter services for 80 years. They've always sheltered homeless men. That's always been their population. That's still the population. For those that may not know, our agency started operating the Solid Rock as Solid Rock Safe Haven in 1999. Before that, it was known as the Solid Rock Mission. A lot of people still call it that. We're not faith-based, so we've kept that. Harbor House, they've been around almost 20 years now. So that's been a tremendous help in our community in terms of providing services to women and to families. CASDA, as many know, they've also expanded their facilities, so they're able to house more in their current location. And then same thing with New Day Shelter in Ashland. So I think since we've started in terms of shelter facilities available, we've seen a dramatic improvement in my time at Northwest. In terms of hotel vouchers and those sort of things, prevention dollars, a lot of that is very driven on funding, and unfortunately, that continues to be a struggle and decrease each year.
So basically federal funds or state or a mix of everything?
Mix of everything.
Okay.
I think it's been very difficult. I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, incomes haven't gone up so much, but rent has gone up, utilities have gone up, gas prices have gone up. So I think the overall number of people facing the issues of poverty, maybe on the verge of homelessness, that number continues to increase each year.
And so what are some of the options that you're seeing them pursue, you know, when they get in these binds where they don't have as much money to meet the rising costs?
Well, yeah, try to work with individuals, connect them to services. You know, are there things that they qualify for that they could be utilizing? You know, have they tried to apply for food stamps? Are they using the senior commodity program? Are you getting your taxes done for free and saving the $600 or $700? But really looking at resources to try to supplement some of their needs to help with that gap. Looking at things like, do you need a GED? Do you maybe need to increase your education? Is there some job skills we could work on so that you're going to have a higher income each month in your household? Maybe the place you're living is not affordable, and you should look at something that maybe is more affordable. Trying to catch individuals early on with prevention and those sort of resources when that one thing happens in their life is a lot easier than once they've been evicted and that's now on their record and they've lost their belongings and they're actually in a shelter. We do have rapid rehousing now. You know, that's another program where we can, for families that are experiencing homelessness, we can help with that first month's rent and deposit for a few months to help them transition off. That is a new initiative that's been around since 2009. So with that program, again, driven by funding sources, we're able to help about 70 individuals. And that's been successful in terms of getting people over that hump, getting them back on their feet, and then being able to continue moving forward.
That's 70 people each year in the five counties you serve?
Yes.
Okay.
Again, it started with the stimulus. A lot of people are familiar with the ERA funds and the stimulus days. It was a new program that came out in those days. At that time, our contract was just shy of $1 million. So we clearly helped a lot more individuals. Right now, with our funds with the state, which is part federal, part state, our allocation is limited. Where now we're only able to serve those 70 individuals a year, not the larger infusion in the demonstration project we've seen years ago.
Well, you know, speaking of housing, is that a big barrier for them as far as finding affordable housing, or what seems to be, because I know you said rising costs was a factor, but what are some of the other factors?
Affordable housing, safe housing, and in many cases, accessible housing. There's a lot of individuals that have some sort of a physical disability, and there's not a lot of houses in the market that can accommodate somebody that's not able to do stairs or needs grab bars in a bathroom. Finding an apartment that, you know, is in good shape. You know, the windows aren't leaking. All the plumbing is working. There's no lead-based paint issues. And there is a shortage of housing. Superior's got, you know, very old housing stock, so there are things that you need to be concerned with lead and some of those other potentials in the houses. The number of individuals that need rent based on income, your subsidized housing programs, there hasn't been an increase, so there continues to be waiting lists. But again, it's very difficult trying to work on a minimum wage job or two, working full time and trying to make everything work is very difficult.
So what about waiting lists? I know you have some transitional housing units here in the area. What kind of waiting lists are you seeing?
Well, in this last year, for the homeless services, we've gone through a process called coordinated entry. So once an individual is identified as homeless in a community, we work with that individual, we complete an intake process, and we complete an assessment. And those individuals, as part of that assessment, they're given a score, and they're put on a priority list. So that way, when there are openings in a program like transitional housing, rapid rehousing, which is, you know, that homeless helping go forward, we use the priority list to determine the highest score and the highest need client and place those into that unit. So there's not a waiting list for each program type per se.
So have you seen the need increase as far as the number of people who are looking for help from you?
Oh, dramatically.
Well, what do you see then? Like, what's kind of typical?
I think there's a lot of individuals that, for no fault of their own, have had things happen. And a 30-day shelter stay is not long enough to try to reestablish, to apply for your benefits, get your kids in school, deal with the medical issue, the loss of a spouse. There's a lot of things that go into becoming homeless. We are also seeing a lot of mental health issues, drug and alcohol issues. But I think the individuals that we're working with tend to have a lot more barriers than they have in the past. Before, it may have been a simple, my hours got cut, my car broke down, help with somebody's rent and they move on, as opposed to now we have, you know, untreated mental illness, they've been evicted 12 times, maybe there's something else on their background which they're not able to get a job, but more issues to have to tackle with each of these individuals than 20 years ago.
Why do you think that's changing? I mean, are we seeing changes like in healthcare or people's ability to access that? I mean, if you're seeing more of those mental health cases kind of enter the picture? Or?
I think it's a lack of services.
Okay.
I mean, in terms of if you're a person on medical assistance, it's very difficult to always find services for medical and dental, somebody that will take that form of insurance. Despite the fact that there is insurance options out there, people still aren't accessing. You know, people have a hard time getting through that process of, you know, where do I go to apply for this program or where do I go to apply for that program? I didn't know I had to do a renewal on this sheet of paper. I think people are still somewhat lost in the process. And for somebody that's never had to use services before, somebody that's maybe waiting on a disability, it gets very frustrating.
So what are some of the things that you would like to see then that kind of help with people being able to get what they need and reduce some of what we're seeing out there? Get more people inside so that they're not sleeping outside in cars or on the street.
I do think we still have a need for more shelter units. I mean, there's many instances where our shelter facilities are full. We just don't have room to take any more households. So I do think there is a need to expand the number of shelter beds and then either to expand the length of time in shelter facilities or increasing programs such as rapid rehousing or transitional housing. Permanent supportive housing is another service we don't have here, but more longer term programs that provide both supportive services that they need in terms of the case manager, you know, how can I help you apply for this or what do you need to help people get over that hurdle as opposed to finding a landlord in community, moving into the apartment, and then it doesn't work.
So it's kind of like people need that helping hand to guide them through the process.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's not a short process. I mean, for many people, it's several months. You know, by the time you are able to get your job, get your kids enrolled in school, or get your daycare services set up, maybe pay on a back bill so you can get a utility put into your name, establish a rental record so that you can get a landlord that will rent to you without assistance. But those things aren't things that can be switched over in 30 days.
So are there cases where, you know, the 30 days are up and families are leaving and not knowing where they're going? Or
I think a lot of us are very flexible. I mean, we do extensions. You know, if we've got somebody that we know, for instance, is got a place they can move into in 2 weeks, or they just started a job and they need another paycheck. I think our local shelters are flexible, that they do give people a little more time than that 30 days. I'm sure there are people that leave with no other options or go back to staying with a friend, staying with a family member, travel to a different community. We do still have homeless individuals that don't want shelter services. We can find them housing, they don't stay. They're not interested in accessing. So we still continue to have, a lot of those are single males, but we do have several of those within our communities. We'll still keep reaching out to them and trying to connect them. Maybe someday we can get them housed. But yeah, there's no two homeless situations that are the same.
Well, and as you're trying to find, you know, what that looks like here in the community, how difficult is that to pinpoint what the need is?
I think we have a lot of things in common. I think we have, you know, housing costs, you know, in terms of increasing affordable housing options. I think that's a common need. I think improving the housing stock expands far beyond even the homeless population. I mean, it's affecting businesses that are recruiting employees. I think the overall housing issue is something that the community has in common. Things like, you know, increasing the number of jobs that are available, job training programs. So there's some of those things we have in common. Superior Days, they've been working for years on expanding mental health services, drug and alcohol issues. So I think there's a few things that we do have in common that we all continue to work on and try to address. The community is great, too, about, you know, donations. We do that Night Without a Home, where all of our agencies come together. So I think we have a great collaboration in our community that maybe you don't see in others.
Well, and as far as that collaboration, or what do you see that's making that difference where time and again you've been wondering how things are going to work out, but then it all comes together? What usually makes the difference in helping people get a home or find a place?
I think it boils down to two things. I think it boils down to building trust in a relationship. You know, an individual that once they've been working with somebody and they get comfortable, they know that that person is there to try to help them and can truly open up and get all the needs out there so they can be worked on. That tends to be a significant help. And I think being creative in our communities. I know both ourselves and Harbor House have both added transitional living programs that we have done within our own organizations that don't receive any federal or state money, but just being creative and looking at expanding resources that we know will help others. And we don't fight over turf. Our facilities housing single men. Harbor House is women and children and families, and CASDA serves victims of sexual and domestic assault. So we're not out in the community competing to serve the same people. We have a unified front of we're all helping homeless and we're all serving different populations.
So is that something that you see, though, as you've talked about, you know, with resources kind of drying up a bit, that you feel like you're competing for fewer dollars, maybe not in this community, but with other ones?
I think so.
Yeah.
Especially the communities throughout different parts of the state where they have more resources. In our northern part of the state, we don't have any permanent supportive housing programs. Our state allocations for the emergency shelter grant, as well as our rapid rehousing, are smaller than other communities. But yet, our population, Douglas County is a metropolitan service area. We've got 46,000 people. So to have a community of this size, we really should have more of an array of services. We often look to Duluth, and you see over there where they have the whole array. You know, they have the permanent supportive housing. They have the wet houses, as they call them. They have veterans housing programs. They have a homeless and runaway youth shelter. But they have the whole gamut, so to speak, of services available. And over here, we've got maybe 3 of the 10 pieces.
Well, and can you send people from Wisconsin to those programs in Duluth, or is there border issues there?
And not necessarily border issues. We all have shelter space issues. You know, we work with the Red Cross quite frequently. They've been generous when we've been full at the Solid Rock with our beds. They brought over cots to help us accommodate. Our shelters over here are a little bit different, where our shelters, we check individuals in. So they're assigned a bed. They have a place to stay that night. So if they get done with work at midnight or 8 o'clock at night or whatever their shift is, that bed's been assigned. Versus Chama operates as a drop-in shelter. So I think in the homeless services, our models are different. One, you need to be there when it opens or you're not going to have a bed. Versus you check in and then you know you've got a place while you're looking for a job or getting done with work or doing those various tasks. The longer-term programs, that priority list I referred to, the list over on that side is at least 100 times larger than ours. So the need is just as great on that side.
Okay. So why is the point and time count next week so important? Is that all about accessing those federal dollars so you can be able to, you know, put those resources to work for people here?
Well, in the point and time count world, and the reason it was intended, yes, it is to demonstrate that we have a need. How many homeless people we have both in shelter and not in shelter on that night throughout the state, so it's an unduplicated number. That is its initial purpose. The more important purpose, I think, is the reaching out. We come across people that may not know where to go to for services. We can give them a warm blanket. We can give them a meal, offer them a shelter stay, but engaging people as well to try to change their situation. So we're obviously, yes, we're doing it to demonstrate we have a need, because that is also very important, but also realizing the human component of it. And that's a woman and her kids living in the car that we really need to get out of that car and into some sort of a shelter program.
So what are some of the stories, you know, and your encounters with people as you're going out and doing this that really stick with you over the years when you've been doing this?
Well, I have a funny one.
Okay.
You know, because you got to have some humor in this. And it wasn't in Douglas County. It was in one of our other rural counties. But we had a group of volunteers that had gone out, and they came across a gentleman who was sleeping in his car. You know, not unusual. This happens all the time. But they had asked this individual, you know, how long he'd been staying in his car and those sort of things. Well, come to find out, he'd had a fight with his wife, and he planned on going back the next day. So we really didn't think he was homeless. So that was kind of one of our, you know, funnier stories. You know, it was kind of a temporary situation, and he might have even been back that night. But that's why he was in his car sleeping at the moment.
Wow.
Was because of the fight with his wife.
Definitely got heated. He had to go cool off.
Some of the sadder stories is we've been working with, like, our hotel voucher program.
Right.
And we've had a family come in, and the children were very bit up with mosquitoes because they had been camping.
Mm.
And it provided them a hotel voucher so they could get off the street. And the mother obviously was very excited, you know, being able to take a shower, being able to sleep in a bed. And the little girls were excited about not being bitten by bugs.
And this was in the summertime when you were
And this was in the summertime.
Yeah.
So some of those, you know, are a little more heartbreaking.
Because it's the small things you take for granted.
Yeah, just the little things you don't think of, like getting bit by mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And the children, you know, still coming in happy with smiles. And, you know, you think about all the things that are wrong, but yet they're smiling and happy and life is good.
All a matter of perspective.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, what do you want to see come as a result of this? What are you hoping, you know, as you reflect on the 20 or so years that you've been with Northwest Wisconsin Community Services Agency? Do you feel like it's getting better, or do you feel like things are getting worse, or is it?
I like to feel like we're holding our own. I mean, consistently, yes, we do have increases in our program areas, but it's also a positive that people are accessing services. We're not seeing the same people. I don't think we'll ever get to a point in our community where nobody's going to be living in poverty. Nobody will experience homelessness. I don't see that day ever coming where there won't be a need for any of the services that are provided. I would hope that at some point, putting more money in those longer-term programs so that we can really make more of an impact as opposed to sheltering somebody kind of short-term. They float for a while, and then they come back. Some of the longer-term programs it would be nice to see added within our community. And the overall housing condition. We've done a lot in the areas of housing. We've done everything from purchasing houses and selling them to low-income. We've built houses and sold them to people. But in the overall community project, looking at overall revamping of housing, Ashland and Superior, which is kind of our two priorities. And I think it's good for a lot of things. I mean, some mixed-use housing, so more affordable housing options for the people we're working with, some high-end housing to attract employers that might want to come and start businesses because then their employees will have nice places to live, which will increase jobs. But looking at things of a more community perspective, that as a community, if we all work together, we really are tied. It's just figuring out what that one common thing is and which of us is going to work on which piece.
Again, that was Millie Roundsville, CEO of Northwest Wisconsin Community Services Agency in Superior. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Kim Randolph with Chum and Duluth about the barriers the city's homeless face in finding a permanent place to stay. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. We're talking about homelessness in this hour, and Kim Randolph is the Director of Stabilizing Services for Churches United in Ministry, or CHUM, in Duluth. She's been with CHUM for 30 years and has witnessed a lot of barriers for people to find housing in the Twin Ports. Randolph says last year's point-in-time count showed more than 1,000 people are homeless in Duluth on any given night. She says most people they come across struggle with mental health issues.
I would say that would be the number one. A lot of people, just by virtue of their income, you know, the poverty, the housing is very hard to come by and very unaffordable for someone with no or little income. I was just talking to a fellow today. He has a mental health problem. I believe it's schizophrenia, and he has two kinds of income. He has two kinds of disability income. One is a small SSI check, which is for people without a work history. Apparently, he had worked at one time, so he has also SSDI, which is for someone who has a work history. And so he has owed money to child support in the past and didn't pay, and so they have garnished all of his SSDI money. So he has only, and he has a severe mental illness, and so his only income, and likely to remain his only income, is $300 a month, which in Duluth is not going to rent anything.
So what then are they resorting to for folks like him?
Well, I think he's been moving from town to town, but I advised him to apply, and plus he has a criminal history, and he's current on paper, so he won't be able to get into any HRA properties for a while until he clears all that up. So I advise that he go to Board and Lodge. He could go, you know, into a GRH-funded Board and Lodge in Minnesota. The state will pay for it until and make applications. There are a couple of funds that will help people with criminal histories, subsidize their, but they take a long time, like a year and a half, to get into. So I suggested he move into a Board and Lodge until something else comes up, and then move on, and try to find work. You know, if he could find some work to add to his income, that would be helpful.
How often are you turning people away then? If we have more than 1,000 people around,
we are not turning people away. We turn people away when they fail to follow through. Like if you have $700 a month in SSI, we expect that you're going to use that money to resolve your situation. And you can't use that money to drink every month or go to the casino and spend it every month or use drugs or any of those. You know, we'll give you a couple of breaks. We expect you're going to use your money rent. And then if you fail to do that, then we might turn them away. We don't turn people away for lack of space. We throw camping mats down. And then if people have been violent in here or predatory, like if someone turns out to be predatory, like scamming people for money or being predatory towards women, then we won't let them in. Or if they're repeatedly violent, that kind of thing. The other reason that we don't turn anyone away for lack of space. When the weather's bad, we kind of suspend our regulations like that, and let people stay while the weather's dangerous. But when the weather moderates, then we will continue to put people out. Although if people are dangerous, we still don't let them in here.
Well, how is that going then? Because we've had some really cold nights.
We've been letting everybody stay. And right now it's moderated. And we are back to talking to some of the folks that we let stay that have, you know, not been following through on their promises.
Well, and I know that we're looking at possibly getting a blizzard over this weekend.
Yeah. So we will suspend that and let people in.
Well, why is the point in time count that you do for the Housing and Urban Development Authority, why is that so important?
I think HUD uses that to determine where they're going to spend their money. And one of the things that has always upset Northern Minnesota is they always do it on January 25, which is likely to be a minus degree day, you know, very harsh weather. And in Duluth, if you are outside on a day like that, you could be dead. And so people are finding hidey holes and friends and anyone that will let them in. And so our numbers, I think, are lower than they should be because we don't find people.
And so you feel like Duluth or the Twin Ports isn't accessing as much money as it could be.
Right. That's always been the thought. The weather is so harsh that we're not finding everyone.
How extensive is your count then? Like, where are you going? Where are you trying to find people?
We at Chum are doing the sheltered count. You know, people that are in shelter. The county is organizing the unsheltered count. They're making as big an effort as possible to find all the unsheltered people. One of our staff is very involved in that.
So what do you feel like is making a difference right now? I mean, I know recently, several years ago, you opened up the Steve O'Neill apartments as far as some emergency shelter. How has that been working, and, you know, what gaps still need to be filled?
It's Steve O'Neill helped, but it didn't mitigate the whole problem. It provided 44 affordable units for families who are chronically in trouble with their housing. But there's so much more needed. We usually have, I mean, we have 6 units in Steve O'Neill that we use for families. But families' issues are much more complicated. Their income needs to be sorted out. Their housing needs are different. And so it takes a lot longer for us to get our families to move through and into housing. And so we usually have more families in our big shelter because the family shelter is full every year than we have in family shelter. So it hasn't solved the problem. It's just a step towards fixing it. And for me, I think we need a variety of kinds of housing. We need housing that understands the problems related to people having severe mental illness or chemical dependency issues, and it needs to be affordable. And the only way that can work is if they are subsidized units. And I know people don't want their tax dollars going to pay for a lot of this, but I think it's cheaper in the long run than to keep trying to deal with the problem. People on the streets cost a lot of money with police and with healthcare. They're in the hospitals a lot, and it's all very expensive. It's just cheaper to put them in some safe, appropriate kinds of housing. Most of our single folks don't need anything fancy. A lot of them just want a safe little room with a lock on the door. More like the SRO, single room occupancy, where they have a 10x10 room, maybe with shared bath, not even necessarily any cooking. They can, there's always a meal around Duluth, but just somewhere safe where they can lock the door and keep their belongings and be off the street.
Again, you've been listening to Kim Randolph with Chum in Duluth. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll bring you part of an interview that some of you may have missed last week about law enforcement and use of deadly force with Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander and Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan. They'll also talk about riot gear, protests, and cultural sensitivity training at the two departments. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next is a portion of an interview that aired last week between Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander and Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan. But some of you may not have heard it due to some technical issues we had last week, so we're bringing it to you again, and I apologize to our listeners who couldn't hear it the first time, and for those of you that may be hearing it again. But here's that conversation with Chief Nick Alexander and Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan about riot gear, protests, and cultural sensitivity at the two departments. But first, Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander talks about law enforcement and the use of deadly force.
So basically, is that threshold when they're threatening you or someone else, like when they're endangering your safety or someone else's safety?
You know, it really for us needs to be the imminent threat of great bodily harm or death to you or another person. And obviously there is the perspective of the officer does come into that. I mean, one officer faced with a person so far away and in a set of situations, not every officer is going to perceive the same things identically, but that's why the standard has always been what a reasonably objective officer would do. Would most officers have responded in that way?
Was there anything you wanted to add on that note? Or?
No, but I guess when I look at things like de-escalation training and professional communications and CIT, what it does too is the officer is approaching these situations probably in a way that is less threatening to people. And instead of throwing fuel on a fire maybe immediately, maybe we're coming in and dealing with these things at the very onset in a way that is lowering that threat assessment and lowering the likelihood that a use of force needs to happen. So, I do think that they do go hand in hand, but it's like a tapestry to weave those skills together. I mean, I'm sure Mike nor I would ever want to compromise our officer safety or tell them to use tactics that, in some form or way would compromise their safety or cause them to be injured or killed.
Well, I guess on the note of officer safety, it seems like in this day and age that things are much more challenging for law enforcement. I mean, if you just look at, the last 20 years with the number of mass shootings that we've seen or incidents of lone actors, like last year we saw that shooting in Las Vegas and a number of other incidents. It just seems like there are more threats out there. And I know recently, Chief Tuscan, you faced some public criticism for your request for riot gear. Could you explain why you were proposing to purchase that riot gear and, how you try to balance protection for your officers with people who may be concerned or the public that may be concerned with militarization of police?
Right. Yeah. Great question. I'm glad you asked. One of your roles as a police chief is to assess not only threats that you see daily, but also to assess potential threats. I know that our officers, we are not equipped nor trained as well as we should in that area. We know that some of the most significant civil disturbances that have happened in recent history in this country have been in two cities that are smaller than Duluth. So, we know that hope isn't a plan. We really, really wish that we will have protective gear that will sit on a shelf and never get used. That said, I feel we're exposed. I feel that if we had an event where there was a significant civil disturbance, we need to be prepared and we need to be equipped. We need to keep our officers safe because our officers being safe keep the community safe. And so to me, it is it's imperative that we are well-equipped and well-prepared to keep 86,265 people safe that live in the city. And we know that we have almost nearly 7 million visitors to the city a year.
I guess what have you seen in the region, in the Twin Ports or in northern Minnesota, that makes you feel like this is something that we need? Like are there specific incidents or things that you've seen that you like? I really like this for my officers. So
I think it's decades ago we should have been more prepared than we are now. So this is not something that's recent as much as it is in strategic planning. This is one of the areas we need to shore up. But also let's look at climate across the entire country. Again, like I said, hope's not a plan. You have to have preparation. I think it our citizens expect that we are prepared on a number of different fronts should there be problems. Both myself and Nick, our organizations, we spend a lot of time and money out at shooting ranges doing firearms, right? So we do that regularly. In fact, we do it 3-4 times a year. But we're not using our firearms all the time. But they're high liability incidents when we do. It is a lot of finality, and lethality is, of course, involved in that. So you want to make sure you do it well when and if you must. So while this protective gear is not something, again, we wish we would keep it on a shelf, we should be very well trained, and we should be very well equipped should the need arise. It just has not been it has not been a priority for our city or police department for many, many years. So it's not really a new issue. It's an issue that has been there for years.
And I guess, Chief Alexander, I'm not aware if you have riot gear or if you're planning on things like that as well.
Our department's had riot gear for many years. We've, you know, as an agency, well before my time, you know, assisted in, I think it was spearfishing riots that took place in south of here in Wisconsin. You can't predict when something is going to become a topic that people are going to become very passionate about and want to protest. I mean, certainly we've seen it in recent events with people concerned for the environment associated with the oil industry or pipelines. But Mike made a great point. We had lunch earlier this week, and it's unfortunately, you know, we've talked about use of force and we've talked about public perception and climate out there. The fact of the matter is either one of our departments could have an officer-involved shooting that could create a lot of civil unrest. And certainly we don't want to impinge on anybody's constitutional rights to protest or to demonstrate or, you know, to engage in activism. But there is a time when, or there have been times where that line is crossed. And, you know, then we do need to be prepared to deal with that. Because, you know, there are businesses, there are citizens, there's personal property out there that, you know, they still have the expectation that the police department, even if it was, say, an officer-involved shooting, that, you know, we might have even had a hand in, you know, creating that storm, they still have that expectation that we're going to be there to protect their property and their persons.
Probably one of the more poignant, I've been doing a lot of discussion with community groups, with some of our city councilors, about this issue, and we're going to do a couple future open sessions as well, is probably most poignantly is somebody who is a activist in Duluth who's been involved in a number of First Amendment assembly and speech issues. He said, I've been there when your police are there. I've been impressed with their professionalism. I know I've been part of or organized these events. And I want to know that if I'm at those events, that the police are have the capacity to protect me exercising my First Amendment rights. And so that comes from somebody who actually is an organizer, who is an activist, who says he sees this as a good, this will ensure I have the freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. And so it isn't just... I'm not clairvoyant. I don't know what those potential threats would or could be, but I know that we should be prepared in the very, very unfortunate advent that something does occur that we need to respond to.
Well, I think that's interesting because I think the opposite view of that has been that you purchasing riot gear or police departments purchasing riot gear is a indirect way of silencing people from exercising their First Amendment rights.
Right. The First Amendment, right? There's a reason it's the First Amendment. In this country, foundationally, people wanted to have voice. They wanted to have freedom of press. They wanted to have assembly. And they didn't want to have tyranny in their government. Police, the very function of policing is to provide people with civil rights. And so betraying that public trust, that social contract we have with our communities, and silencing our community is completely contrary to what our mission is. And so it is very important for people And we will always stand up and protect and put ourselves in harm's way to defend the right to freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of press.
I'm obviously very glad to hear
that. I knew you would be.
I agree with Mike completely, too. I mean, our presence at many of the types of events, whether it's a demonstration, a protest, or whatnot, it's equally there. It's to protect the people that are going to participate in it as much as, you know, others who may disagree or, you know, have other interests involved in it, whether it be property or whatnot.
Well, you know, so I look at just another example. You had Dallas cops that were shot.
Right.
Dallas cops were there to protect free speech of Black Lives Matter who were protesting fundamentally police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that brutality is targeted or oftentimes against people of color and African Americans. So they died in protecting freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And so that is a core function of law enforcement, is to protect those civil liberties that we all enjoy as Americans.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about that, because it seems like a lot of the interactions that are happening between police or law enforcement and community groups has to deal with racial or ethnic issues or, you know, having cultural sensitivity and interactions mm-hmm. with the public. How do you go about that as law enforcement officers? What are you doing? How is that working for you? I know it's come up in hiring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where are you at with that?
I'll give you, that's about a 10-minute answer, but I'll give you try to kind of a shorter answer. First and foremost, I think it comes from hiring diversity. Your community, your police department should reflect the community they police. I think next, last year we brought in fair and impartial policing for our entire organization. Very expensive training. State of Minnesota has just increased per officer reimbursement from about $333 to just under $1,000. With the idea that the extra funding is going to be used for cultural sensitivity and diversity training and de-escalation training. And so there is an investment now here in 2018. We're going to get additional dollars to just focus on that. But I think more importantly the most important task I can accomplish with our communities of color is to be present, be engaged, and have their voices be heard. We have a relationship. We build relationships with our community, our entire community. And I think that is very important. When you're in crisis, and I noted some cities previously, and you look at some previous cities where there's been rioting, many times those incidents didn't happen as a result of a bad incident that day. It goes back 20 or 30 years because nobody invested any relationship capital in the neighborhoods that were marginalized, that suffered from poverty, that suffered from crime. And so it is incumbent upon us to engage our entire community, and especially those communities where we know people are suffering from poverty and are marginalized.
A lot of the same things for us over here in Superior. You know, we've really made a dedicated effort the last 3 years to build relationships with all members of our community in diverse groups. And we do it on campus with students. We do it with specialized student groups, the First Nations groups or the Black Student Union. We, you know, work with gender groups, the Superior African Heritage community. I mean, we're always out there trying to build relationships. So when and if something bad does happen, that one, we're not strangers. We've had dialogue, we've had meetings, we've had discussions on areas that we disagree. So, I mean, I think that's a big step in the right direction. And you know, we were talking about the riot gear. I think a good example of, you know, Mike talking about, you know, it's a tool that we're going to have on a shelf, and we have it, and we're prepared if we need it. Well, good evidence of that is there's been plenty of protests and demonstrations in the Twin Ports, both on both sides of the bridge in the last 3 years, and nobody has seen that stuff. And I know Mike's looking to get new stuff, but I believe that you likely had some stuff that you could have used. So, I mean, if the premise was that if you have it, you're going to use it, that's not the case. I mean, our agencies have had it for a long time, and it's only used in very specific circumstances. And a better example of it is that our departments are usually involved in many of these protests and demonstrations that have happened, where we're working with the organizers in advance of them to kind of have security plans, you know, how we're going to deal with people if they get out of hand, those types of things. Oftentimes, Mike or I even speak at them, you know, to talk about our dedication to fair and impartial policing. And my increase in the training budget for 2018 also is to bring in implicit or unconscious bias training to kind of get at the core of some of those sensitivities that people may have. I think that's very important. I'm often asked, what's the most important trait for a police officer? And, you know, I think people are expecting to hear courage or honesty and integrity. It's like, those are, I just expect that. I mean, you have to come to the table with that. What I want to see a great officer have is empathy. And somebody who has empathy and can take into the consideration all of the things that have led up to you having contact with a particular person, whether they're in crisis or they need a rest or whatnot, that is really a quality that leads to all of these things, reduction in citizen complaints, reduction in use of force incidents, better relationships with community members.
All right. Well, thank you both. I appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, you are listening to Superior Police Chief Nick Alexander and Duluth Police Chief Mike Tuscan. That's it for our program. You can hear all of our programs online at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. And you can hear us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.